Well, good morning, everybody. Welcome to Resolution's interim results presentation. We have a lot of material to get through today. There's the normal stuff. We'll go through this agenda in the course of today. My feeling for this is it's probably going to take about 50 minutes, 60 minutes to get through this. There is a lot of material. There's a requirement for there to be a lot of material. Just a quick word to say that we've announced a number of changes today and signposted a way forward, and I've no doubt we'll come back to that, and I will certainly cover some of that at the end of the presentation. But the key message I'd like you to take away as you go through today's presentation is this remains a Resolution company. There is still work to be done in terms of creating value, deriving value from the assets that we own. The fact that we are more normalising and standardising this company, making it more like kind of general UK governance would look like, does not change the basic investment thesis and the fact that there are still significant prizes for shareholders to be derived from active farming of the assets, whether that's driving out capital synergies, cost synergies, wherever that goes. So for those of you who remember the Resolution 1 strategy, not that I'm going to go back there very often, it's exactly the same. We are here to derive value for the shareholders, and that story has not changed today. Okay, with that, I'm going to hand over to Andy, and you'll see me again at the end just before we take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning. I'm going to cover the business review of the first half, and in summary, there are four key messages I want you to take away. Firstly, we've been very clear about the business strategy for the group as we set out last November. It is unchanged and it's right for this market environment. The UK life sector is ex-growth, and this is exacerbated by the tough economic and regulatory conditions. This requires rigorous financial discipline and ruthless allocation of capital. Secondly, the execution of this strategy is on track. We are turning around the operating performance of the group, and we have good momentum for the rest of the transformation over the next 18 months. The third key message is, what are we creating? What's in it for investors? This transformation is creating a sustainable, profitable, cash-generative business with the three divisions that we set out last November. Heritage is our cash engine, supporting our strong dividend, alongside our two growth engines, UK go-to-market and international. And following on from this, the final message is that these three divisions will therefore support our strong cash dividend for shareholders and profitable growth to deliver strong long-term returns for shareholders. So let me move on to the headlines in the first half. The starting point is that the group has a robust capital base. Jim will cover this in more detail shortly, including the good progress we've made over the last 6 months in further strengthening our economic capital position. With this solid foundation, the transformation of the business is on track. Taking each of our three divisions in turn, Heritage, our cash engine, is delivering on its strategy, completing the Diligenta outsource in March and launching Friends Life Investments in July. And in terms of our two growth engines, UK go-to-market has made strong progress in improving both value of new business and new business strain. And international, where there is more to do, has the majority of the new management team on board, and they are taking the required actions to rebalance value, volume and risk, creating the platform for future profitable growth. So let's see how that's translating into results. Our headline results show further progress towards our market targets. So we focus on cash generation now and longer-term returns, and we start with our 2010 baseline, which is the annualised 2010 results from the three businesses we bought, and shows the poor underlying financials of those businesses in 2010. We then track the progress over the three-year period to deliver our 2013 targets. So we're currently halfway through that period. Starting with cash, on the top half of the slide, We are holding sustainable free surplus year on year in a tough environment. Further significant reductions in new business strain, underpinned by further progress on cost synergies, are offset by targeted investment spend, which we do not expect to recur at this level, and the impact of lower interest rates on our shareholder assets, which are conservatively invested in cash and short-term gilts and bonds. Tim will talk more about this shortly. Two other points to draw out. Firstly, the benefit of a lot of our management actions last year came through in the year-end basis review, and hence only in H2 numbers. So care is needed in comparing H1 of this year with H2 of last year. Secondly, you can see in the top right here that there's a further 80 million of cost synergies still to emerge to benefit sustainable free surplus, and our confidence here is key to the decision to increase our dividend. In terms of returns, on the bottom half of the slide, we've made excellent progress on our value of new business in the U.K., which has already exceeded the whole of last year. The result for Friends Provident International, whilst broadly flat on prior year, does reflect the start of a rebalancing of value, volume, and risk. The Lombard result reflects a much tougher economic environment in the first half of 2012 compared to the first half of 2011. The combination of these effects has led to a step forward in both our IRR and, in particular, our return on embedded value. So let's take each division in turn, starting with Heritage. We set out our strategy last November with a dedicated commercial management team focused on a series of initiatives to realize embedded value and maximize cash and returns. This is unique. No other U.K. open company has set up a Heritage business in this way, and I'm pleased today to announce the appointment of Jonathan Moss as the CEO of our Heritage division. Jonathan brings a wealth of experience in managing back books, latterly as the Group Chief Executive of Phoenix. So we said last November we would outsource the remaining administration and IT. We executed on this in March, and hence our costs will reduce by 60 million per annum by the end of 2015. In addition, our embedded value is de-risked with more of the cost base variable. We also announced our plan to launch our asset manager, Friends Life Investments. This went live in July when the first 6 billion of assets arrived, with more to come this year. And we've made further progress in reducing new business strain and improving cost efficiency, while persistency is in line with assumptions. Looking forward, beyond the outsourcing and asset management initiatives, the key focus is the capital optimization program, where we're on track with this year's program and are now mailing policyholders. We're also simplifying the management framework of our with-profit funds. Moving on to our U.K. go-to-market division, while the overall U.K. life sector is ex-growth, there are pockets of value, and hence there's a common focus across all three U.K. go-to-market businesses of selective participation, creating lean, low-cost, 21st-century businesses, each powered by a single main platform. We then exit all unprofitable segments, removing all costs with no cross-subsidies. Again, rigorous financial discipline is essential to ensure capital will be invested at good returns. I'll cover each of these three businesses in turn, starting with corporate benefits. Our strategy here is applying rigorous financial discipline by focusing on our existing book, where we now have 79% on our target platform, improving cost efficiency, and pricing discipline in taking on new schemes, all supported by the successful launch of our new corporate wrap platform, MyMoney, in March. These initiatives have enabled us to double the value of new business in the first half, albeit from a low base, but the IRR remains at an unacceptable level. The economics of this market are challenging, but going forward, our strategy reflects the fact that regulatory change is favorable here. The retail distribution review is expected to reduce churn. Automatic enrollment, which will start in early 2013 for the Friends Life book, will significantly increase income with limited cost impact, given our processes are highly automated. Hence, we believe we can improve our financials here. The second of our U.K. go-to-market business units is protection, a market with limited growth but good margins. The strategy here is moving new business to our target platform, now 81%, with a strong customer proposition, increased focus on critical illness and income protection, and what is a common theme across the whole group, significantly improved cost efficiency. The execution of this strategy is driving substantial improvement in both value of new business and new business strain. Going forward, the focus is in two areas. Firstly, migration of our tied distribution partners onto our target platform, including the launch of our new partnership with Connells, the U.K.'s second-largest estate agency, in March. Secondly, preparing for the regulatory changes in the protection market, where gender-neutral pricing and taxation changes will move market pricing. Both of these are critical to delivering one of the toughest of our U.K. new business targets. Finally, in the U.K. go-to-market division, our retirement income business. This is the largest and fastest-growing profit pool in the U.K. market. We are well placed for profitable growth, with 2 billion per annum of maturing pensions, which is 11% of the total market, especially given we start from below-average retention rates. Operating performance is pleasing, with growth in both margins and volumes, the volumes driven by the addition of the Winterthur Life business rather than increased retention rates, giving significant upside as we improve retention rates in due course. Again, the strategy we set out in November is on track, with the majority of the benefits expected to emerge, as we said before, in  2013. There are three key areas of focus. Firstly, improving our customer proposition, where we launched our enhanced annuity in June. Secondly, our asset management strategy, where the launch of Friends Life Investments last month is a big step forward. Thirdly, we have a series of initiatives to improve customer engagement and hence increase retention rates. Finally, I'll cover our international division. I'll talk about Friends Provident International in a moment, but I'll start with Lombard. Lombard is the leading pan-European specialist in compliant estate and succession planning solutions for high and ultra-high net worth individuals using life assurance. This is a large, growing market, and we believe private banks will drive the majority of this wealth transfer over time, and hence it's central to our strategy to build stronger relationships with them. Lombard is a good business that is performing well in a tough market environment. We have delivered significant growth in market share and are making progress in our strategy to shift our mix of business towards private banks. While this is lower margin, it's also lower risk, more sustainable, and offers much stronger growth potential in the medium term. We've also announced a major reconfiguration of Lombard's head office that will see more than 20% of our workforce leave the business over the next 18 months and deliver new technology to enhance customer and partner service. That's Lombard. In terms of Friends Provident International, our focus here is on value, not volume, while also improving the risk profile. We're starting to make some progress, with margins up and new business strain down, even after the impact of a significant investment in the risk and control framework as part of de-risking this business. Our priorities going forward will be a continued focus on value, not volume, and again, on cost efficiency to deliver a sustainable, profitable, low-risk business. As with Lombard, we will talk more about our strategy at our planned International Investor Day in the fourth quarter, where you'll get the chance to meet some of the new management team. In addition to John van der Wielen, our CEO of International, who joined at the end of last year, during the first half of this year, we've appointed a new CEO of Lombard, new general managers in Asia and Europe, and a new strategy and marketing director. While there is work to do to rebalance value, volume, and risk, once this is done, I am confident that our international businesses will deliver strong, profitable growth for the group. Bringing all that together, this is a recut of the slide we've shown you previously, showing progress to our targets, where we're on track in underlying performance, that the economic headwinds are impacting the overall outcome. It's also worth mentioning that sustainable free surplus generated in the life companies is only paid up to the holding company at the year end, and hence only contributes to the DCT here at the year end. Therefore, the low numbers on the slide here does not include any of the 120 million of sustainable free surplus generated in the first half. The one key point I'd like to draw out here is that while we remain committed to our and retain our 400 million distributable cash target every year, and we remain committed to generating this from sustainable sources in the medium term, as most of you have worked out already, in this low interest rate environment, it's particularly challenging to get this from sustainable sources in the short term, given we want to maintain a robust, low-risk balance sheet. In addition, we remain committed to delivering the 10% return on embedded value target in the medium term, but recognise that achieving that in 2013 looks increasingly challenging in this economic environment. And Tim will cover both these points in more detail shortly. So to summarise, four key messages. One, we have a clear strategy which reflects the realities of the UK life sector and the economic environment and is underpinned by rigorous financial discipline. Two, execution is progressing well. We've transformed the business. There is still much more to be done as we're only halfway through, but we're on track. Three, as a result, we're on track to create a sustainable, profitable, cash-generative business with our heritage division as the cash engine and two growth engines in UK go-to-market and international. And finally, in terms of what's in it for investors, we remain committed to generating 400 million of distributable cash from sustainable sources in the medium term to support our strong cash dividend for shareholders and a 10% return on embedded value, which in turn will support long-term growth in returns for shareholders. And with that, I'll hand over to Tim, who'll cover the financial review. Tim.
Thank you very much, Andy, and good morning, everybody. I'm delighted to be here to present the group's financial results for the first half of 2012. Now, Andy's already covered our new business performance, so I'm going to talk through the group's financial performance in some detail and then hand over to Jim, who will provide an update on cash and capital. Well, as Andy has said, despite the difficult economic environment, the group delivered a resilient performance in line with our expectations and demonstrating the benefits of the tough financial discipline within the business and the strategy which we set out last year. The strong improvement in the UK value of new business flowed through to the group MCV operating profit, which is up 31% on the first half of last year. IFRS operating profits, however, were impacted by the general economic environment and were down even after excluding one-off reserving changes in both periods. Sustainable free surplus improved on the first half of 2011 due to the benefits of reduced UK new business strain. However, these benefits were offset by the impact of economics and some targeted development spend. Group net MCV increased 2% on the full year, but the group maintained a robust capital position with an IGCA surplus of £1.9 billion, similar to the full year position after taking account of the Friends dividend to resolution. Movements in group ASC, available shareholder cash, reflect primarily the dividend paid to shareholders and debt repayments. So let's start off by looking at the IFRS result in more detail. Well, removing last year's one-off items, which principally related to benefits from the implementation of negative reserves on protection business, and similarly ignoring reserving changes and one-off items this year, IFRS profits are down 22%. Well, this is a little bit disappointing when we see the benefits of new business strain reductions. But in reality, the fall was mainly as a result of a 60 million reduction in in-force surplus across the group, which I will break out in further detail in a moment. At a segmental level, the reduction in operating profit was driven almost entirely by FPI and Lombard, where the businesses have been impacted by challenging economic conditions as well as strategic one-off costs to deliver future efficiencies. UK underlying on operating profits of £105 million are broadly flat on last year, and this is especially pleasing considering the current market difficulties. Underpinning this performance was a reduction in new business strain, offset by a lower in-force surplus and slightly higher development costs. And the overall performance benefited from the cost synergy delivery and an increased proportion of new business being written on our target platforms. The reserving changes and one-offs on the right-hand side are mainly within our UK operations and principally relate to revisions to transfer payments for guaranteed annuity business between the with-profit and the non-profit funds. So let's take a closer look at the key drivers causing the reduction in in-force surplus. Well, the fall was driven by the negative impact of economic returns, both on annual management charges on unit-linked business and an increase in the return of premium guarantees on some German policies in FPI. In addition to the economic impacts, we've incurred some £10 million of strategic one-off costs as we set up our asset management business, Friends Life Investments, and undertake a strategic review of our international businesses. And we have included here some severance costs in Lombard that Andy referred to earlier. The waterfall also highlights a number of other adverse movements within reserving and experience variances. Roughly half of this relates to the absence of some small favourable items from the first half of last year. But there are also some negatives in this period, for example, some minor foreign exchange movements. And we have included here an adjustment within Lombard, updating the fair value of its long-term incentive plan for joiners and leavers. Looking beyond this result, the delta between the operating result and the IFRS loss after tax mainly reflects the impact of non-recurring costs and acquisition accounting adjustments. Given the significant non-recurring spend, which is broken out in the detailed box top right, I just want to highlight the benefits and capabilities that these investments are delivering. As we all know, we're partway through integrating what we believe were two significantly underinvested in businesses. Whilst this takes a significant cost in doing this, I have been pleased with the progress that both our integration program and our outsourcing agreement have made in this period, and more about that in a second. But aside from these programs, we have continued the necessary improvements in our financial reporting models, systems, and processes, which not only improve our control environment, but also prepare us for the Solvency II regulatory regime. Lastly, but also importantly, our capital optimisation work continues, and this will reduce the number of life companies we operate, leading to a much simplified legal structure and allowing us to further optimise capital requirements across the group. I now want to look for a second at operating expenses in the UK, which is, of course, the majority of our cost base. Well, on a like-for-like basis, UK operating expenses are down 7% on the first half of last year as a result of good progress on integration and as the benefits of the outsourcing arrangement are delivered. This is evident in the level of acquisition costs, which have reduced £16 million and is a key driver of the significant improvement of new business strain, of course. We expect the synergies to flow through maintenance costs as the integration process continues and as the benefits of the variable cost base come through. Whilst a part of this saving has been invested in targeted development spend, I am pleased with the progress made on cost reduction. And having achieved £65 million of run rate synergies at the half year, we're confident that we're on track to meet our run rate synergy targets of £112 million by the end of next year and £143 million by the end of 2015. Now, the £112 million target synergies by the end of next year will be achieved through a number of activities, which include the rationalisation of sales and marketing capabilities, savings across back office, customer service and IT functions, through, for example, a reduced number of propositions, the decommissioning of legacy IT platforms, and sourcing better commercial terms for IT infrastructure. But we'll also get savings from the right sizing of central and support functions once delivery of key strategic projects is complete. And this will allow some selected property rationalisation. The remaining £31 million of savings to reach our 2015 target will be realised from contractualised synergies achieved through our agreement with Diligenta. So let me turn now to MCEV. Well, as I said earlier, Group MCV operating profit is up 31% to £235 million. And of course, this is driven primarily by the strong UK operating performance, which benefited from the significant improvement in the value of new business. Now, aside from economic impacts, the Lombard operating drop of £15 million shown here had two main components. Firstly, a reduction in the value of new business, symptomatic of the conscious shift of new business origins from IFAs to private banks that Andy mentioned. And secondly, LTIP costs relating to the valuation adjustment that I covered a few moments ago. FPI profits rose by 20%, although, to be honest, this is mainly due to the fact that the first half of last year included some negative impacts from some modelling corrections, and such impacts are not repeated this time. So having looked at the segmental split, I just want to look at the makeup of the result for a moment. Well, the key components of an MCV result are, of course, familiar to us all. And the main driver of the increased result is the 139% growth in UK new business profits. We've been through this already, so I'm going to look at the other elements in a bit more detail. Well, expected existing business contribution, or EEBC as we call it, is essentially the unwind of embedded value in line with assumptions. EEBC of £165 million was lower than the first half of 2011 and reflects two main impacts. Firstly, the revision of our expected long-term investment returns in line with economic conditions at the start of this year. And secondly, a lower opening VIF, due of course to the economic impacts from year-end 2011. So both rate and volume variances are adverse this time. The positive contribution from other operating items mainly relates to the revisions to transfer payments for guaranteed annuity business, the same as we saw in IFRS. But this also includes the one-off strategic costs I referred to earlier, although these were to some extent offset by some limited but positive assumption changes for expenses. But in line with our normal practice, a full review of assumptions will take place in the second half of the year. Other movements here relate to FLG and resolution corporate and finance costs and development costs, which at £22 million are £8 million higher than last year, but do reflect the investment in our go-to-market businesses, the benefits we are starting to see, as Andy explained, and also preparation costs for regulatory changes coming in shortly. Overall, the embedded value of the business increased 5% to just over £6 billion before the return of cash to shareholders. This was largely a result of the operating profit contribution of the business and positive economic variances. Economic variances here reflect the differences between actual and expected return and are largely in line with our published sensitivities. We've also seen an additional positive variance included here of £40 million arising from a reduction in our future expense inflation assumption. Now, I'm conscious that we don't currently publish an inflation sensitivity, but I am considering whether we should do so in the future. After allowing for these economic variances and tax, other operating items reduced MCV by £92 million. This relates to the non-recurring costs that we discussed earlier, partially offset by the embedded value benefit of the reduction of 1% in the corporate tax rate. So having discussed IFRS and MCV, let's just look for a second at sustainable free surplus. Well, excluding the impact of acquisitions and disposals, which offset each other as you can see, sustainable free surplus improved on the first half of 2011, mainly as a result of the benefits of significant reduction in new business strain. But this was offset by negative economic impacts and a number of targeted one-off investments. The £10 million negative economic impacts relates mainly to equity falls in 2011, reducing expected annual management charges from unit-linked business this year. And the one-off investments that I mentioned here relate to a spike in development costs this year and strategic one-off costs, both of which we have commented on earlier. I've mentioned several times this morning the impact of economics. And you will also have noted our comments this morning about the likely delay in achieving our targeted ROEV in 2013 and our distributable cash target from sustainable sources. So I want to spend a bit of time explaining how these economic headwinds are impacting our business. Well, we all know that interest rates in the UK are at historic lows. This graph shows the average three-month LIBOR forward rate as a proxy for the rates that impact our free surplus generation. And I've plotted it here over a number of periods from when the market targets for the UK Life project were set through until June 2012. As you can see from the graph, LIBOR forward rates have fallen over the past 2 years, with a marked reduction within the last 12 months. Current 2012 rates are approximately 1% lower than foreseen 2 years ago, and the rates for 2013 to 15 have fallen in some periods by over 2%. These lower returns have hindered our ability to generate surplus from our invested shareholder assets, which gross of debt about £2.4 billion. We estimate that the negative impact on annual surplus emergence compared to 2 years ago is about £25 million this time, and the shortfall will grow to between £40 and £50 million per annum in a couple of years if future rates match current expectations. Now, the low interest rate environment also impacts our return on embedded value, which is highly dependent on the level of return achieved on existing business. Now, two of the key drivers of this are, of course, the long-term expected returns on equities and property. Whilst our views of the risk premiums over risk-free are unchanged, a direct consequence of lower long-term risk-free asset returns is that our long-term total expected equity and property return assumptions have reduced by almost 2 percentage points to 5.4 and 4.4% respectively since the ROEV target was set. I estimate that this fall in returns reduces our annual ROEV by between 50 and 75 basis points. Delivering both the 10% plus ROEV and £400 million of distributable cash from sustainable sources remain our medium-term objectives. But looking at this and the previous slide together, we can see that should current economic conditions and investment market volatility persist, including, as I said, future interest rates following the current market view, then achieving these targets may be delayed. In this regard, let me look briefly at the development of ROEV over the half. Well, annualised ROEV for the period was 6.4%, which is 60 basis points higher than the full year 2011 return if I exclude from last year's return the one-offs and I also adjust it for opening MCEV. This was primarily driven by the significant improvement in the value of new business and supplemented by operational experience variances, which, as we have seen, are an overall positive for the period. But we can see here the impact of economics on the lower EEBC achieved compared to last year, as I explained a few moments ago. And now turning to the bottom half of this slide. Well, excluding one-offs for the first half of this year, ROEV was 6.2%. And the chart goes on to show the levers that we have available to deliver our target. Ignoring any uplift from improving returns on shareholder assets as and when rates improve, we are growing our VNB towards our targets and are constantly evaluating initiatives that would improve ROEV. But of course, whilst VNB growth will also be critical, growth beyond our existing individual product targets would help bridge the gap. But we are not guiding to any new targets today. So let me summarise. We continue to make good progress with growing new business profits, supported by a lower cost base and improved new business strain, and we've maintained a robust capital base. The transformation achieved over the last 18 months continues, and whilst good progress has been made, there is still much to do to create the successful and sustainably cash generative business for the future. I'm now going to hand over to Jim. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim, and good morning, everybody. As Tim has already outlined, we've taken action to improve operational cash generation. In addition to improving this cash position, the group also remains committed to the ongoing optimisation of capital and the return of excess to shareholders. Our actions have ensured that the group has a robust balance sheet at the 30th of June, and we've increased the dividend by 5% based on our confidence in the overall sustainability of the cash position. We recognise that in light of this, many shareholders are puzzled as well as disappointed by the decision to cancel the second £250 million capital return that the company announced it would target in June 2011. In the first 6 months of 2012, we've continued to experience a challenging economic environment against which we must evaluate the sensitivity of the group's capital base. We have also seen an evolving regulatory environment with the perceived but understandable hardening of approach to retention of capital in the UK life industry. It is against this environment backdrop that we have assessed the future capital requirements of the business. Our agenda for today will therefore set out the capital framework, explain the sensitivity of our capital base to key economic risks, and outline our expectations in respect of future working capital requirements. We will clarify our rationale for the decision on the £250 million return and look at the implications for the future. As is common in the UK life industry, the overall capital framework for the group is based on the MCEV. We then have to manage capital on three specific bases. For the Friends Life Group, the regulatory test that applies is the Insurance Group Capital Adequacy Hard Test. For the individual life companies, the capital requirement is based on the higher of Pillar 1, the regulatory rules-based assessment, or on Pillar 2, the economic capital assessment. In sharing the position with you today, I do not propose to cover Pillar 1 in any detail. This basis is closely aligned to the IGCA position. The economic capital is based on a consolidated life company view, together with the fungible assets available at group. It is therefore not a Pillar 2 basis, as this strictly only applies at individual life company level. The results, however, are derived from our consolidated ICA and will include amounts set by the FSA as individual capital guidance, should they apply. On each basis, we have calculated the surplus currently available. This surplus then covers a number of uses. The first of these is to cover the capital required over and above the solvency capital in order to meet our capital management policies. For MCEV, the left-hand column of the three, this has already been deducted in arriving at free surplus. For IGCA, the middle column, our policy is to hold 150% of capital requirement, and for the FLG economic capital, the right-hand column, it is 125% of economic capital with individual life companies on a Pillar 2 basis. Further allocations are then made for restricted assets, for non-fungible capital that cannot readily be returned, and for working capital, including monitoring buffers. Monitoring buffers are specific amounts held to ensure compliance with regulatory requirements and our capital commitments on our management policies. Working capital also covers amounts held to support the payment of dividend by FLG to resolution until sustainable cash generation is able to do so, and it also funds one-off costs arising from the transformation of the business, as Tim has outlined. After these allocations, we're left with available shareholder cash on an MCEV basis or available surplus on an IGCA and economic capital basis. As we've previously advised, the group intends to retain a prudence buffer of £400 million from available shareholder cash. This buffer is retained to support the dividend should cash flow from the life businesses be constrained. It also covers a decision, which I shall come back to later, to hold 1 year's FLG debt servicing costs in cash, as well as covering resolutions, debt and corporate costs. In assessing the adequacy of the buffer, we've taken account of the current weak and uncertain economic environment and sensitivity of our capital base to various economic exposures. Our summary conclusion is that in view of the potential for an economic market shock, especially one which impacts on credit spreads, we consider it prudent to maintain our robust capital position. In order to ensure we comply with regulatory requirements across all bases, the group manages against three key aspects of capital resources. Firstly, as the company has previously disclosed, there are limits on the amount of value that can be transferred out of the UK group without FSA consent. This is why we need regulatory approval for returns of excess capital. Second, the group maintains capital levels in line with its capital management policies, as I have already outlined. The third component is to hold sufficient capital in available cash over and above the capital management policy to cover at least 1 year's debt servicing cost at both life company and group level. This requirement was introduced this year and is intended to ensure that our debt commitments do not lead to a breach of our capital management policies. In view of these requirements, including the new commitment to cover future debt servicing costs, and in response to a perceived hardening of the overall regulatory approach to prudential management, we have established specific monitoring buffers. These ensure compliance with our capital management policies and regulatory commitments. The establishment of these buffers has led to an increase in the level of working capital that we now expect to hold. These buffers are an additional 10% for IGCA at FLG, and at life company level, 20% for Pillar 1, and 10%, albeit of a larger number, for economic capital. The group would not expect to release capital from the life company or FLG at any point if these monitoring buffers would be breached as a result. Having outlined the framework, I propose to review the influences on each slide, on each of the capital bases, but also to speed up the time for each of the slides in case those of you that are flipping ahead are getting worried about sleeping arrangements. This is slide format that I've used on several previous occasions to illustrate our MCEV capital framework. This shows the level of shareholder resources, free surplus, and after deduction of working capital, 619 million of available shareholder cash. In the box in the bottom right-hand corner, it also shows that on an MCEV basis, we have nearly 1.3 billion of debt, representing a gearing ratio of 17.7% of the gross MCEV. On an MCEV basis, shareholder resources, after grossing up for the 1.3 billion debt I've just outlined, are 3.2 billion. This is the amount of surplus capital over the statutory minimum. As set out in the column on the left, 2 billion of this is held to meet capital management policies in excess of the statutory minimum, 150% of the IGCA requirement. The remaining 1.2 billion is free surplus. The uses of this free surplus are shown in the middle column. Major elements being the 0.4 billion to cover the cash prudence buffer I've already outlined, and 0.6 billion held as working capital. The working capital, as then shown in the right-hand column, has a number of components. The monitoring buffer, established as I previously outlined, of 0.2 billion, 0.1 billion to cover non-recurring costs, less currently anticipated non-operating benefits, and 0.2 billion retained to smooth the temporary shortfall in expected sustainable cash generation. The amount retained for smoothing is based on the current 350 million annual cash dividends expected to be paid by FLG to resolution holding companies to fund resolution's dividends to shareholders for debt servicing and for other corporate costs. It also includes the contribution to the 2012 final dividend generated in the first half of the year. As Andy outlined earlier, this has been retained in the life companies as our normal policies to review the amount of cash that can be released at the end of each year. Finally, working capital also included 0.1 billion of restricted assets that are not distributable. The IGCA position shows a very similar picture. Of the total 1.9 billion surplus over statutory requirements, 0.9 billion is required to cover the 150% capital management policy. As with MCEV, the excess covers the 2012 interim dividend, the working capital requirement, and 0.4 billion prudence buffer. Working capital of 0.5 billion is 0.1 billion lower than the MCEV basis, as there are no restricted assets here. These were taken into account on the IGCA basis when calculating the surplus of 1.9 billion in the first place. Whilst the IGCA basis is the binding constraint at the 30th of June 2012, after taking account of working capital requirements and the prudence buffer, it is the economic capital requirement that is potentially more restrictive in stress scenarios. As the company announced in March, whilst the IGCA position was the constraining requirement for the group at 31 December 2011, the economic capital basis was on the cusp of biting. This reflected our evaluation of economic capital requirements in the first quarter of 2012, which had significantly increased as a result of widening corporate bond spreads and our assessment of the overall level of economic risk, particularly in Europe. This effectively requires us to provide a greater level of prudence, as the economic capital position is considerably more volatile than the Pillar 1 and IGCA capital bases. We committed to keep the potential to make the 250 million capital return under review and stated that we would take into account the performance and stability of markets since the end of 2011 and the impact of planned management actions to further optimise capital and address the impact of market volatility. Whilst markets remained volatile in the first 6 months, indeed we saw significant worsening in April, we did benefit from the planned management actions. These included improvements in our modelling that enabled us to reduce prudence margins, equity hedging, and de-risking of elements of the corporate bond portfolio. We also benefited from reduced operating risk as a result of our ongoing investment in financial systems and controls. Overall, the economic capital surplus position has improved by 0.6 billion since the 31st December 2011, and we remain focused on identifying ongoing capital optimisation opportunities. As a result of this improvement, the estimated FLG surplus on an economic capital basis at 30th of June 2012 was 3 billion, a coverage ratio of 174% of capital requirements. If we look at this 3 billion in more detail, this being the surplus over capital requirements, in the same way as we looked at it for MCV and IGCA, it highlights there is potentially 300 million of available capital in excess of management policies, prudence buffers and other commitments as at the 30th of June this year. Of the 3 billion, 1 billion is required to meet the capital management policy. Of the remaining 2 billion, 0.4 billion is restricted, primarily in relation to our international businesses. The regulatory requirement is for Pillar 2 to be calculated at life company level, and at Friends Life Limited level, we then consolidate the UK life entities. Whilst the international businesses have surplus assets on a notional Pillar 2 basis, they are not subject to this regime, and their surpluses are not recognised as fungible when we consider FLL's consolidated position. As with other bases, the surplus also covers working capital requirements and the 400 million prudence buffer. The higher working capital requirement on the economic capital basis, 0.8 billion compared to 0.5 billion for IGCA, is primarily a reflection of the need to hold a larger monitoring buffer, given the greater sensitivities to key risks. The imposition of the monitoring buffer has partially offset the increase in surplus that arise from the result of management actions in the period. The difference in sensitivities to key risks is best illustrated by considering the impact on the FLL position. This slide sets out the impact of potential equity, interest rate and corporate bond spread sensitivities for FLL on both a Pillar 1 and economic capital basis. IGCA does not apply at the FLL life company level, but the Pillar 1 stress is a reasonable approximation of the anticipated IGCA impact. As can clearly be seen, the sensitivity to corporate bond spread widening is the most acute, especially on an economic capital basis. In the event of a 200 bip widening of corporate bond spreads, the 1 billion of estimated excess capital in FLL at 30th of June would fall by slightly less than 1.0 billion on an economic capital basis, leaving minimal capital above our capital management policy. Clearly, this is still significantly above statutory solvency requirements, but in accordance with our capital management framework, the release of capital from the life company to pay dividends to FLG would not be possible in these extreme circumstances. Economic capital is the more sensitive basis, as it is a dynamic economic capital estimate that essentially assumes that in bad times, we need to hold even more capital on the assumption things are going to get even worse, i.e. it is pro-cyclical. Pillar 1, by comparison, is a linear, rules-based calculation. Economic capital also takes into account the impact on the value of in-force business of holding corporate bonds in the unit-linked portfolio, and the impact on the business of potential changes in valuation to the defined benefit pension schemes. Whilst this sensitivity has a potentially significant impact on the business, for much of the bond portfolio, this impact should reverse over time unless we experience actual defaults. The assets are held to duration and not traded. The quality of the bond portfolio is therefore critically important. Over 80% of the sensitivity for FLL on an economic capital basis derives from the corporate portfolio backing non-profit liabilities and shareholder funds. We consider the portfolio of assets in these funds to be of strong rating quality, with 97% of investment grade BBB or better at the 30th of June 2012, marginally improved from 96% at the end of 2011. Against these assets, we hold default reserves of 0.6 billion. During the first 6 months of 2012, there were no defaults, and experience last year was negligible. Whilst we remain concerned by the economic crisis in Europe and the potential knock-on impact to credit spreads globally, our direct exposure to sovereign debt, the so-called PIGS countries, is only 7 million. Overall exposure to corporate bonds of businesses in these countries is 365 million, much of which is secured by the cash flow of their UK operating businesses. It is therefore the temporary impact of spread widening rather than absolute defaults that impacts us most. Returning then to the overall implications of the current capital position. In making the decision on whether or not to return the 250 million of capital, we took into account a number of considerations. The base for the decision was the capital position of the group for the 30th of June 2012, as set out in this presentation on each of the key bases. From this base position, we considered the expected future capital requirements of the Friends Life Group, including the need to institute specific monitoring buffers as we ensure we comply with our regulatory commitments and this resulting increase in our working capital requirements. Economic uncertainty also remains a material factor. The conditions that gave rise to us strengthening our economic capital requirements for credit risk in the first quarter of 2012 persist and may well be considered by many to have deteriorated since we outlined our concerns in March this year. Despite the management actions that have improved the FLG economic surplus by 0.6 billion in the period, the sensitivity of our economic capital base to market stresses, especially the mechanistic impact of widening corporate bond spreads, remains a significant factor in our overall capital management considerations. In light of all of these factors, the board determined that it would be inappropriate to make the 250 million capital return originally targeted for the first half of 2012 and consequently announced its cancellation. Whilst it was not a material factor in the consideration of the immediate return of capital, we also remain focused on the continuing evolution of Solvency II requirements. Implementation has already been delayed, and further delay is, in our opinion, likely. Our view of the impact of the proposed regulations on the group has worsened in the last 12 months, and further delays, coupled with the weak European economy, could increase the difficulty in anticipating the final outcome. In light of this uncertainty, we cannot anticipate any releases of excess capital solely as a result of Solvency II implementation. Whilst we regret having to make the decision not to return capital, we retain our confidence in the robustness of the group's capital position and the improving cash generation. In light of this, the interim dividend has been increased by 5% over existing guidance to 7.05 pence per share. We expect to recommend an equivalent uplift to guidance in our recommendations to shareholders in respect of the 2012 final dividend, which, subject to board and shareholder approval, would be a year-on-year increase in dividend per share of 6.3%. In view of the announcement of the change in the structural arrangements today and the removal of an expectation of a specific exit event by the end of 2014, the board will consider the potential to move to progressive dividend once sustainable cash generation meets our 400 million per annum distributable cash target. I do appreciate your attention to what is, in so many respects, a challenging area to fully explain. We do remain confident in the capital position of the group. We have a robust capital position on all bases. Our management of capital is prudent, an approach we believe to be essential in these weak and uncertain investment and economic markets. We recognise that this economic environment and an understandable perceived hardening of the regulatory approach to prudential management pose potential challenges to our overall capital management objectives. Whilst these are not totally within our gift to manage, our working capital retentions, overall prudence and improving cash generation underpin our confidence in increasing the dividend by 5% and in committing to the return of excess capital when markets and regulatory approval allow. On that note, I'll hand you over to Clive, who will provide a wider strategic update on the company.
Thanks, Jim. Is it the one on the right to go forward?
Yeah.
Great. Good morning. I just want to take one brief look over our shoulder, one look at where we are today, and then one look going forward. I think Andy has covered in some depth the strategy that we're on at a detailed level, so I no need to repeat those points, but just to put them in the wider context of how we see the UK life sector at the moment and what the opportunities for that are. I think we start with a brief look over our shoulder. You'll recognise this slide, those of you with good memories, although I think I saw something in the paper last week that reminded us the credit crisis started 5 years ago. I don't know if any of you are feeling old, but I don't know where the 5 years went. And it's sometimes hard to remember what the environment was and what the market expectations were in 2009. But these were the expectations that we had when, having just sold Resolution 1 in 2008, we decided in 2009 that the UK life insurance sector was ripe with opportunity and that we would make that one of our early and initial focuses for investment. The three key things we believe, many believed, investors certainly believe, during that period were the following. Number one, that there was value from consolidation in the life sector. That we had already proved. We'd put together a number of insurance companies before in Resolution 1. We knew there were synergies. We'd extracted them. We knew that you could release capital. We knew there were tax benefits. We knew that if you were tough on the product lines that were being sold, you could reduce volume but increase value and therefore reduce new business strain from those lines you decided to keep open. And we thought other values too, for example, in the asset management side of these different businesses. So yes, absolutely, we saw value from consolidation. Secondly, we believed, and we had every dialogue with everybody in the market that therefore confirmed we were right to believe, that there were new business franchises likely to become available in 09, 010 and 011 from companies that were planning very meaningful disposal activity. Indeed, in two cases, two very large cases, at the time that we put the company together in 2009, we thought that very substantial new business franchises, available literally free, because as you know, Resolution never pays, only pays a discount to embedded value and therefore never pays for new business franchises, would come available from companies that had decided to radically restructure, either to make meaningful reinvestments outside of the United Kingdom in other high growth areas that they perceived were important to their group, or because they had other structural issues to manage their way through. We also saw there were some mid-sized strugglers. Those are the middle ones with the question mark in the box. I think it would be fair to describe both AXA's UK business and Friend Provident at that stage as two good, perfect examples of the types of assets that we had in mind at that stage. And we saw a number of closed life funds still around, but we had very limited interest in those. We certainly, however, thought that substantial scale assets could be bought during the next window. And as I say, some of them with very meaningful new business franchises for which you had paid literally nothing. And the third thing we believe was that there was great value to be unlocked for investors in the life insurance sector by getting rid of the black box. And in particular, getting rid of the automatic assumption that a pound of emerging surplus in the in-force automatically and without a question went into new business. It simply was always going to be rechanneled into growing market share. And that's why we've remained as strong as we are, and indeed you heard Andy reconfirm our commitment to thinking about the business in two very, very distinct ways. That there is a stabilised in-force, and then there's the option to invest a dollar out of that in new business. But it's got to pass a value test before it gets reinvested. If not, it's straight back to investors. So those were the three things that we believed as we came into this sector in 2009. Well, what happened? Well, you know what happened. You lived through the whole journey with us. In 09 and 010, we got on with acquiring, and we acquired in the mid-size. We never got the scale new business platform available at an acceptable price that would come from the top end of that pyramid from those large transactions, particularly the two that we were in dialogue. One case in dialogue for over 18 months as they and we sought to find a way to make a match that would work and would meet both their corporate needs and our own. Against that backdrop too, market conditions and volatility have, as you've just heard both Tim and Jim mention, lowered the earnings that come off the in-force portfolio and require you to hold back capital in the prudent way that has just been described. And regulatory uncertainty about the future capability to release the capital that we saw available in the sector at the time as we went into this continues going forward. So what do we have? We have mid-size acquisitions then. We've got stuff in the middle. And they would have provided synergies. You've heard from Andy and Tim the progress towards those synergy targets of $143 million to be delivered by 2015 and on track, bang on track for making that delivery. That's real creation of value. In rising markets, somebody would put a value on that close to a billion in terms of, a forward multiple. We acquired well. We got what we saw as, on an economic basis, good prices, paying 67% of net embedded value for the assets that we bought. And we have already begun the UK new business rationalisation. So already UK cash drain reduced by £180 million. So doing things and making money the old-fashioned way, but against the backdrop of a market that doesn't reward you yet for those actions, given market prices. We've also brought in, from scratch, a new team to lead the assets that we've acquired. And the focus of that team, from day one, is on focusing on securing maximum value from each part of the group. However, as we look at it today, and we look with a forward view of 12 to 18 months against the original timetable of a 2013/early 2014 exit, it's no longer helpful to shareholders for us to be targeting a specific exit event. Can't call the future direction of markets, but from here you would look forward and say you are not doing the best thing for shareholders to be specifically targeting a future exit event. Rather, we should focus on the securing of the value and the extraction of value of the assets we've got. And provided our headset and bias remains continually on returning cash to investors and on securing maximum value from the assets over time, then we go into the next market environment, at least underpinned by the operational performance of what we have today. So where are we? Well, no longer seeking acquisitions. We think the acquisition phase absolutely behind here. Continuing the operational value delivery on synergies, cash flow and delivery of targets that you heard from Andy and Tim today. That does include growing the new business organically, but with a focus on cash and financial discipline. And as Andy says, continually viewing the business through those two separate entities of the back book and the new business that's sold under the Friends Life brand. Still very keen on a progressive dividend when the sustainable cash generation reaches the $400 million distributable cash target. And as you heard from Jim, absolutely with a bias to resuming returns of capital when market conditions allow. And very much still focused, after all, this is resolution, on securing maximum value from each part of the group. We are people who have deliberately and on purpose come into the insurance sector, and we are here deliberately on purpose as opposed to having chosen to have long-term careers within it. And therefore, securing maximum value from each part of the group remains very much part of our DNA. Given where we are and given that we have no longer pursuing acquisitions, we think now is the appropriate time to replace the temporary project structure that was in place and in the way the company was structured when we sponsored its formation, and therefore the separate team within ROL that was part of a separate entity due to be unwound at the time that the project was complete or the exit was acquired. It, in our view, is inappropriate to keep that separate from the business anymore. And so we are, as you've heard here, moving to a standard operating and governance model, and we will be working over the next few months to normalise all those. So that's where we are today. Let me hand you to Mike.
Thank you very much, Clive. Okay, so let's just be quite clear. Today, RSL and ROL have jointly announced a move towards a standard normalised board and governance model, the ending of the operating agreement, the transfer of key ROL staff to RSL, the limiting of the 20 million non-UK life funding to 5 million, that there will be no specific exit event and that the company is not seeking acquisitions. So there are a number of pretty important key statements there. I think going on to the second bullet, though, it is important to recognise that there are some quite complex commercial and contractual arrangements that now need to be renegotiated. And we've set ourselves the target of achieving that over the next 6 months. That may involve a shareholder vote. I don't know yet, but I want to make sure that we have enough buffer to accommodate that if that's required. And finally, to say that it's clear that ROL remains a supportive shareholder going forward. In summary, I think you can see very good, robust progress in terms of the underlying progress within the business. There are some important announcements to date today, but it remains a resolution company focused on creating value for shareholders. Okay, with that, I'm not going to the appendices, I'm going to questions. Could I ask you please to state your name and company as you ask your question? This gentleman in the front, please. Thank you.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Ashik Musadi from JP Morgan. A couple of questions. Can you give us some timeline on the 400 million DCT as we'll get some sense of how much the dividend will be supported from capital and the non-operating items for how long, basically? That's the first one. Second, in terms of the 400 million target, assuming that's a free surplus, sustainable free surplus generation, now you have done 120 now, first half, let's say 240 for full year. So basically you're still 160 million short. And you have given all the cash synergies delivered, basically 92% is done. So how should we bridge that gap from 240 to 400, if you could give more color on that? Thank you.
Okay, in terms of we retain the distributable cash target of 400 million every year. The point is it will take longer to get there from sustainable sources, while given we want to maintain a robust balance sheet that's low risk, and hence effectively the interest rates earned on the shareholder capital are lower. So, but we retain the DCT target of 400 million a year. In terms of how we get there, the key point to look at is the cost synergies. So there's a further 80 million of cost synergies still to emerge. And then obviously there's further opportunities in terms of commission and improving in-force surpluses as well within the book. So those are the key levers as Tim set out on his slide.
So just to follow up on that, I guess like your free surplus generation is a function of two things. First is in-force release, and second is the new business strain. Now, I looked into the accounts, page number 50 and 51. The new business strain basically is cash strain and required capital strain. Now, cash strain is all you have achieved, what is 92%. So what am I missing here? Is it I'm missing the higher in-force release, or if you can give color on that?
So the new business strain is just the cash strain. It doesn't include the required capital. So that's the other dimension in the mix.
All right, thank you.
Can I add a bit of colour to that? I think that it's important to understand some of the phasings here. Your half-on-half comparison is fair, but I think it's important to look also at what happens between the first half of a year and a second half of a year. So last year, for example, we had 122 in the first half, 170-odd of free surplus generation in the second half. So this time's 120 compares to 122 first half last year. Those are your two starting bricks. But the improvement in the new business strain gave us a very significant benefit, nice big blue brick on my waterfall, taking the number up. What I then have deliberately done is put in a subtotal, because we've then targeted specifically a couple of areas for strategic investment which will drive future performance. So on the left-hand side of my subtotal, I've got the improvements coming through new business strain driven by, exactly as Andy said, some of the continued delivery in the benefit coming from the synergies and the cost reduction initiatives that we have in place. Driven by the UK, 7% reduction in costs in the first half, much more to come as we deliver on the savings. The right-hand side of my subtotal, we've been very clear today, we don't expect to see the same level of development spending in future years as we're seeing in the current year, which has costs associated with some of the regulatory changes that are coming, as well as the implementation of some of the strategic initiatives in the international businesses. The second half last year, much stronger than the first half. Why? Two things primarily to remember when you want to annualise this. Firstly, the second half of Lombard is always much stronger than the first half. It's a very, very second half or even Q4 skewed vehicle. Costs incurred pretty much consistently in 12th over the 12 months, but income very much skewed to the end of the year. And so the gearing, little g, effect on free surplus generation, very much skewed to second half. Saw that last year. If the team do their job this year, I'd hope to see that again this time around. And also the nature of the FPI surplus is also skewed towards generation of more of their surplus towards the second half. That's structural features of some of their products and how that unwinds. So I'd encourage you not to take a simple 120 and double it and go, ooh, that looks a bit light, but to think about some of the other phasings and some of the initiatives. That's what gives me the confidence to talk about improving surplus generation, and that with the capital base has enabled us to increase the dividend.
James?
Morning, James Pearce from UBS. A couple of things. First of all, the relationship going forwards with Roll. Should we be looking for further fees to Roll in H2 and next year, and if so, how much? Second, when's the day of reckoning for the value share going to be, and how will that be tested, what time period and so forth? On the comments on no more M&A, given Friends Life's subscale ROE and an ex-growth market, why not do further M&A? Is that because you've gone off it with a low return environment, or you're not ready for it, or what? And just finally, on the FTSE membership, have you had discussions with the FSA as to whether the new arrangements will be compliant?
Right. The first one is about the fee. What we've said there is that we're looking to the earliest possible date that we can terminate the operating agreement is December 2013. You can work out what that would mean if there wasn't an earlier termination in terms of fee. All I'm saying is that there is a discussion to be had, a commercial and contractual discussion to be had between RSO and ROL, and I'm not going to go there today. All I'm telling you is that if the board has a contractual position that it could exercise, and that would be the earliest date on which that operating agreement could terminate. But clearly, everything we have said today has been a joint statement between ROL and RSL, because we agree on what we are saying there. I guess what I'm saying is there is further discussion to be had, but I'm not going to promise anything to anybody yet about where that would lead. Those negotiations are going to be complex, and they have many facets to them. Your second question was? Nothing about today's announcement has triggered the value share. The value share is one of the things that we'll be looking at as part of the contractual and commercial renegotiation. Your third question was?
Why rule out M&A?
Can I add a quick comment, Mike, because the second part of the question mentioned Friends Life being subscale. I beg to differ. $6.5 billion embedded value, 5.5 million customers. If you take some of our core markets, Lombard's the market leader in pan-European estate and succession planning insurance solutions. In corporate benefits, we're number two by assets under management. Protection, we're number four by premium. So I'm comfortable that we have sufficient scale in our core market areas to compete successfully organically going forward. So I don't start from a place of we need to do M&A to get scale to be able to compete successfully. I'm confident we'll compete successfully with the businesses that we have.
I mean, clearly, just going on from that, the board has a fiduciary responsibility to consider all potential M&A activity, and nothing in this statement takes that away from the board's powers and responsibilities. The board has that responsibility to the shareholders, so it's not going to ignore that responsibility. I think all I'm saying is we're not actively seeking acquisitions. That's the point that we're making there. And your fourth point was?
Yeah. I think you asked specifically, James, have we discussed with the FSA as to whether or not this proposal would be compliant with wherever it comes out? To which the answer is no, we haven't. The proposals from the regulator are expected sometime this quarter, we believe. Having been through in some detail the proposals when they were in consultancy stage, we do believe that all of the things that we've addressed today would lead us to be compliant. Ultimately, the listing remains of paramount and of importance to the group. And were any further tweaks required, which we don't believe is likely, we would, of course, make sure that we protect that listing.
Okay. Oliver. Down here. Thank you. Sorry, I'm not ignoring the back of the room. I'm working backwards.
Oliver Steele at Deutsche Bank. There's a question on the DCT again. You've got a $213 million... buffer, which is sort of something about smoothing you know, towards the 400 million annual sustainable payment. How is that calculated? Because on the face of it, it seems to include the 98 million for the interim dividend. So that takes it down to 115 million odd that on a net basis. And, you know, I mean, that would appear to be round about, you know, the rest of this year's difference between a 400 million cash payment. So does that mean that actually you expect to get to the 400 million next year? Because clearly that doesn't tie in with the sort of statements you're making.
Just to try and clarify that, it doesn't include the interim dividend. What it that's separately held if you look at the analysis I gave through, because that's due to be paid in October. What it does include is the surplus that was generated in the first half of the year that would actually go towards the final dividend next year. Because by the time we get to the end of the year, we like to have the dividend sitting there in cash ready to pay out for the next 12 months. So your principle is right, but the amount obviously will reflect the final and therefore is the contribution of the first 6 months. Secondly, it's based on 350, not on 300 as I outlined when I went through it. 350 being the current level of contribution from the Friends Life Group to resolution to meet its dividend and debt requirements, and it's that the resolution dividend is based on. So it's based on 350. So to answer your question, it is based around that, is based around a surplus of roughly 120 million that will go towards next year's dividend. So the balance of that will give you the size of it and the likely pace, therefore, at which we currently expect to achieve our targets.
Yes, so the point is, it's the difference between sustainable free surplus we expect to generate and 350 million. Also includes the 120 million surplus from the first half. Clearly, to get to the 400 million, we still have opportunity to generate surplus from non-sustainable sources, which isn't included within that calculation.
Okay. Sammy, can you work further back, please? The gentleman there, three rows back.
Hi, it's Colin Simpson from Goldman Sachs. Just a point of clarification, please, Jim. Does your economic stress test on the credit spreads include a liquidity premium or countercyclical premium adjustment?
Yeah, effectively, the 200 bip is a corporate bond stress, and we would expect roughly one-third of that to translate into credit and two-thirds to liquidity to the extent it applies to the annuity book. So it's 67 on credit. Broadly.
Good. Sorry. Gordon.
Thanks. Gordon Aitken from Royal Bank of Canada. Now, you mentioned the major block to returning the second 250 was the risk of corporate bond spread widening. Now, why not hedge out the spread risk either partially or fully? And if you had hedged some of that risk, would you have been able to return some capital? Or is it a case that you mentioned this tougher regulatory environment, would the response from the regulator have been, you know, in this uncertain economic environment, no life company is returning any cash over and above any ordinary dividend?
I can't tell you what the response of the regulator would be because we have to ask the regulator. But in terms of the credit spreads and the hedging out, we have undertaken some de-risking of our portfolio. You will note from what I outlined earlier that actually, though, the fundamental is about the mechanistic movement as opposed to absolute value loss. And were we to take out such hedging, which generally is quite expensive, if it's available and effective, we would potentially give a significant element of return away for a temporary cash flow benefit. And there is a trade-off in there.
But a significant driver of the 600 million improvement in the economic capital position from the year end to the half year that Jim talked about earlier is a number of actions to de-risk and hedging activities. So that type of idea is a sort of thing that we do look at on an ongoing basis, and that's one of the reasons for that improvement in the economic capital position in the first half.
Come back to the second part of your point, Gordon. Were we to have done that and taken the operational hit in terms of the impact on ongoing cash generation, we would not necessarily be able to definitively say we would have been able to return it.
Further along.
Yeah, good morning. Andy Broadfield from Barclays. Two questions. One, you've talked about the DCT progress, warned us not to think 120 times two because there's other things that seasonal that come through later in the year. There's still some one-offs potentially as well. What you haven't then added in there is that you haven't realised the full impact of market movements, I think. Is that right? You've said that it comes to 50 in total as we are today, but actually the experience to date is not the full 50 million of headwinds from low investment returns. It's actually 25 or a bit less than that. So should I be taking a little bit more headwind going forward on my cash surplus generation when I'm thinking about the go forward from here? The second question is, for simplicity, on slide 41, when you talk about the IGCA surplus, given that's the binding constraint, I guess that's where we should think about the dividend paying capacity. It seems to me that you're saying we can support, or you can support, the dividend payment despite the fact the free cash generation may not be big enough in itself to pay the guided 21 pence per share, but that you'll pay it out as some sort of capital pool. When I look at those blue boxes on the right-hand side of the chart, which of those is going to be supporting the dividend payment if the free cash generation doesn't?
So I take the first part.
You do the first part, I'll do the second part.
The impact of economics on the DCT, you're right, and I wanted to draw that out. I was hoping I was drawing that out from my, if you remember my chart with the 3-month LIBOR forward curves on it. The impact to the left-hand side of the page is around about 20, 25 million this year. You can see roughly half of that, I guess, in the 10 million in the first half on my previous slide, which was the free surplus waterfall. So yes, that 10 will become 20-ish for the rest of the year. By the time you look forward into the outer years, if interest rates follow the current implied market view, which would be that bottom royal blue or black line across the bottom of the graph, then you could be looking at a 40 to 50 million reduction in free surplus generation because of the way that our shareholder net worth is invested, which is in very low risk cash and gilts primarily.
But the key point there is that's relative to the expectation when we sent the 400 before. So that interest rate curve at the bottom is flat. So there isn't a further 30 to come off of what's currently happening. Interest rates are already at that low level. But the point is that we originally communicated a 400 million target from sustainable sources. And since the communication of that, the interest rates have basically led to that being about 50 million less. And that's why that's now in the medium term. So that's the point. It's not off the current level. We're already at the low interest rate and expected to stay at that level based on that.
But you've still got the reinvestment rate scenario to flow through to next year, effectively. Because you're saying you only had half of it this year.
It depends what interest rates are, yeah. But if
we take the static position as it is today, then we've still got that headwind to come through the system for next year.
No, it just means you wouldn't see the growth that had been expected in the chart that underpinned the market guidance when that was given 2 years ago.
Okay, clear. And then the second question on the IGCA.
In terms of which components, there are three components on there. The top one, the interim dividend, clearly is coming back as the interim dividend. The second, working capital, has just over 200 million of smoothing provision to pay future dividends, so that's part of the answer. And then the ASC prudence buffer is also retained to support dividends if necessary.
So you would run that ASC down?
If circumstances allowed us to, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Depends on the reason why the individual cash is not coming out of the life businesses.
Trevor?
Hi, it's Trevor Moss from Berenberg. Can I just explore the wording around this, the return to a progressive dividend when hitting cash targets, what that means. You've raised the dividend by 5% at this half year with implications for the future dividend for the year end. Are we saying that dividend level will then remain flat until such time as you hit the DCT target and then you will go from a progressive dividend from there? I'm unclear as to what you're actually suggesting for the dividend going forward beyond this year.
Well, I'm suggesting that the board will make its evaluations at each point, given what's going on. In other words, that the current philosophy applies until such time as that DCT hits the target. At that point, the board will consider a progressive dividend policy.
What is the current dividend policy, then? That's the I guess, you know, it's hard to determine exactly from the progressive dividend that you've just paid, up 5%, that your current dividend policy is anything other than progressive. So what's... I don't... Am I just being stupid
I think these are semantics.
Okay. I can give you a little clarification for healthcare, which is the 5% under your scenario would remain relatively flat, barring anything else happening within the business, until the sustainable cash is meeting our expected long-term cash target.
What I'm not going to be doing is tell people what the dividend is before the board's had a chance to actually consider what it should be. Anyway, gentleman up there.
Good morning, it's Marcus Rivaldi from Morgan Stanley. A couple of questions, please. First of all, you talked about when you originally were talking about splitting the business, considering the self-managed exit route, about moving the bonds, I think, into the Heritage Co. What's going to happen to your publicly listed debt with this revision to strategy today? Secondly, just thinking about the sort of corporate governance changes, and Roll is still conducting its R&D work on asset management companies and closed books in Europe. So in the event that you want to pull the trigger on one of those projects, would that come out of Resolution Limited, or would there be a separate company? I'm just trying to think of, in the event of some sort of exit down the line, does Andy, do you have to resign your position today and go back into the Life Group if you were going to transition with that company to a new ownership or something like that?
Can we pick that second one up?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think the second one is straightforward. RSL owns FLG, and that's all we're doing. If Roll do anything else, they'll do it through separate vehicles. I'm employed by RSL, and I'll be carrying on doing this. I'm not going anywhere other than staying here, delivering cash and return to shareholders.
Correct.
In terms of the first bit, well, Tim?
On the public debt, there's no changes planned on anything to do with where our public debt is issued and held or in place in the group.
But we are continuing...
There's no impact from what we do today.
We are continuing the work within Friends Life to create the separate heritage business, UK go-to-market and international, because that's the way I want to run the group organically going forward. And we are committed to splitting the UK financials between heritage and UK go-to-market with our prelims next March.
But previously, we're also thinking about them shifting the debt down to Heritage Co. at some point as well.
Not sure I remember that from any previous announcements, but if... If you had read that into it, then let me just make it easy for you. Nothing's going to change on the debt from where it's issued today, from where it's guaranteed today, etc. So whatever you thought might be changing is not changing.
I think the point that you're referring to is we had previously indicated that in a separate IPO, the default position would be that debt remains secured by the heritage book. So clearly, given that we've ruled out today the separate IPO, in those circumstances, that ceases to be an issue.
Yep.
Thanks.
Sorry, Tim. Gentleman
here, Jane? Sorry. Just here. Abdul from Jefferies. Just one question, if I may, on your economic capital. I'm just wondering, what level are you calibrating that to?
That's effectively based around a 1 in 200 event.
So is that BBB?
That's more of a credit rating job to... evaluate the mine. It's based around a 1 in 200 event.
So. Okay, thanks.
Okay. Andrew. Whoever.
Okay, hello. It's Barry Corns, Pamela Gordon. Just a very quick point of clarification, similar to Trevor's point, really. You say the company will no longer seek acquisitions. If an acquisition came your way, as opposed to you seeking it out, can you just clarify whether or not you'd entertain?
Well, I tried to be clear there that the board has a fiduciary responsibility going forward. It will do the things that any normal board would do in that set of circumstances. I think what we're trying to signal here is that that sense of going out and hunting for it has completely stopped. Okay, so in that sense, we will be a normal board.
Okay, thank you.
And to that end, Mike, I mean, that, again, is another rationale pragmatically for why you would begin to stand down the separate unit that used to do that as a day job and start moving those people into line roles in the business. So if one were to come to us, there's not a team whose day job is to sit there and analyse those transactions anymore in the way that it has been during the acquisition period and the structure we have between ROL and RSL.
Andrew.
It's Andrew Queen, with Autonomous. Can I ask a question around the international business? The aim was to generate 50 million of cash from that. Is that still the aim by 2013 as part of the 400 million? And would you look to sell any of those businesses, or are they in a position at the moment where they need fixing before for sale, particularly I'm thinking of FPI? So that was one area. The second area is, coming back to Trevor's point, the argument always was that you generated 400 million of cash, then 125 million was required for Roll and for servicing the AXA loan notes, which left you 275 million of dividend. And the market, I think, picked up on the fact that if you could replace the AXA loan notes or repay them through disposal proceeds, then there was a capacity to pay a significantly higher dividend. And I think what Trevor's getting at is Progressive always rather sort of seems 5%, 5%. And if you did manage to achieve that, would the market still be right to look for a material step up in the dividend?
Okay. Do you want to start off with Lombard?
I'll do international, and then Tim can comment on the debt position. So we remain committed, and what we've committed to is a 20 million per annum dividend from Friends Provident International from 2013 and 30 million per annum from Lombard from 2014. We remain committed to those dividends from the international businesses. Much consistent with the message of the rest of today, in this market environment, M&A activity seems pretty unlikely. What we're focusing on is getting our heads down and seeking to improve the value, volume and risk profile of the international businesses. I'm confident that they can make a strong, profitable growth contribution to the group going forward in a way that generates dividends. Equally, I will not fall in love with any part of the group, and we will always be looking to secure maximum value from any part of the group over time.
The M&A environment is not that bad in Asia.
As I say, we're focusing on securing maximum value from any part of the group at any point in time. We're executing a strategy to improve the cash generation from the international businesses and rebalance value, volume and risk. The board will consider what will secure maximum value from any part of the group over time.
Yep. Now,
thank you. On the second part of your question, Andrew, I wouldn't necessarily agree that you had to take 125 for what Resolution and Roll required to get 400 down to 275. Friends has passed up 350 million each year rather than 400, and that's enough to meet the requirements for the external dividend, the operating costs and the servicing the AXA notes. That's one of the reasons why I'm not unduly concerned, disappointed, yes, but not unduly concerned that our ability to generate free surplus in the current low interest rate environment may be impacted by, as I said in my slide, 40 to 50 million. So that would get me maybe from 400 to 350, which is actually what we pass up today. So to come back to the earlier point, it's more of a lost upside rather than a problem in terms of cash generation. With regard to the AXA notes, I've read your note. I've seen others that have made similar comments as well. It's one of these things. We always have these kind of things under review. They have been in the past. They would be in the future. But I wouldn't be signalling in advance anything that we might or might not be thinking about in that regard. And I certainly wouldn't want to commit the board to anything in advance of a debate about what it might do with the proceeds or the opportunity of having those notes repaid in terms of what that would do to dividend policy. That would be a decision for the board at the time, having looked at the capital position, the economic environment and how the business was performing.
Yep. Neil, any questions from the web? There are no questions on the web. Are there any other questions? So, Andrew?
Just looking at the economic capital position and the sensitivity of £1 billion to credit spreads, that's very different from the underlying sensitivity on the MCEV on which the economic capital is based. And is it something which the regulator insists on within a Pillar 2 situation? Because there's certain other companies with sort of three or four times the amount of corporate bonds who I think be struggling if they applied that test.
It's not something the regulator insists upon necessarily. It is our evaluation of the impact to our economic capital of that widening, and therefore the sensitivities are the basis on which we look at it. I clearly can't comment on the basis on which others look at it or what their economic capital circumstances are.
Why is it so different to the MCEV sensitivity on which it's based?
The fundamental element of the Pillar 2 economic model is different to the MCEV model.
But it's a factor of 2.5 times. I mean, it's not inconsequential.
It's the same difference I was trying to explain between Pillar 1 and Pillar 2, where you have a different basis to the nature of the modelling, and it fully reflects the elements included in respect of illiquidity premium as well.
Could you expand on your comment that Solvency II was looking worse for you at the moment than it was before?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to look at the changes that have come through on Solvency II since the KIS 5, which is really what my comment was around contract boundaries and the potential matching. So whilst we're still comfortable with the base of the company's capital, my point was really that over the period of delay, we have seen further changes, and because we anticipate further delay, we can't with any clarity say what the end position is going to be. It's not that we think it's necessarily going to be worse, it might be better. We just cannot foresee what the end position is going to be.
But the deterioration is a market-wide impact. It's not specific to us. So you know, contract boundaries, matching adjustments, general delays, discussions around it all is just extending in an environment of increasing regulatory focus on this.
Good. Well, thank you very much. There are no further questions. Thank you very much for being here with us today, and travel home safely. Thank you.